This isn't just a quirk, you know, that Dave and I like to wait until the last moment to know what we should share. And it isn't because we're like living on the edge. It's simply because we really do believe that Jesus Christ is the head of the church. And we listen. We love to listen, to hear what God is saying, what he's doing. And different things will come through. It's really important that we kind of listen. Someone used to say this, we begin to get given two ears and one mouth. And there's a hint there. So it's good to kind of listen and to hear what God is saying. Remember Jesus said, I always do those things that I see my Father doing. And I think it's important when we have the freedom to do this, that we listen to hear what the Father's doing, what he's saying, and then share what's in our heart. I've had kind of several things in my heart that have been kind of bubbling away. I always get a little bit twitchy when people quote me, as Pete was doing earlier on. Most of the time I have no recollection of having said any of the things that people quote back to me. I say to Morgan, I say, I think I'm a legend. I think I'm a fake legend often. People kind of quote things to me that I'm sure I've never said. But in this instance, I do remember it. But I want to kind of make a point. And that is this, that what I was really saying at that time, if I remember, is that in the Bible, the word guilt is never used of an emotion. It's never used of a feeling. It is a judicial sentence. It's the thing that the judge says. So that really, if we want to understand our emotions as Christians, this isn't just being pedantic. It's good to try and find the right word to express what's happening. It doesn't mean I don't feel accused at times. It doesn't feel I don't feel unclean at times if I've done things that are wrong. But it does mean I don't use the word guilty. And I don't use the word guilty because only the judge has the right to use the word guilty. If I'm in a court of law and I'm found guilty, the judge isn't at all interested in how I feel about it. I may find myself fine, but it doesn't make any difference. And I may feel bad about something that's gone wrong, but if he says not guilty, the judicial sentence is not guilty. And it's important when you get particularly into Paul's letters in Romans, particularly Romans, that we understand that when the Bible talks about guilt, it's not talking about a feeling. It's talking about the judge's sentence. And because the judge has sentenced him instead of us, there is literally no condemnation for us. Because there was a pattern. The pattern was, there was an accusation, there was the process of the court that went on. Then finally the judge would make a statement, guilty, and then there would be the execution of the sentence or condemnation. But if the judge says, not guilty, there is no condemnation. Literally, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. So that's what I was talking. I'm sure Pete knew that anyway. I'd like to just remind you of what Dave said the first time we were together. That spoke very strongly to my heart. And he was talking then about in a sense, the fact that this wasn't intended just to be a kind of the Dave and Ron show. That's not how we regard this kind of particular time. But we come here and we really do want to be part of what God is doing. We both regard preaching, I think, as body ministry and not as a performance. So we're listening, we're waiting, and we understand that you must make a contribution to this. Do you remember how Paul said to the Corinthians, there are some things I can't say to you? Well, there are some things I can't say to you unless you're in the state where you can receive them. But there are some things I would never have said if you hadn't have been in the state to receive them, and it draws it out. And it's a wonderful process. It's very exciting. I was saying this at breakfast. It's very exciting, actually, to be preaching, kind of thinking like this. 2 Corinthians, Dave was in, wasn't he? And he was in chapter 9, and in a sense, the wind-up at the end was, I think, pretty much around about verse 8. I mean, he went to the end of the chapter, I know. But in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 8, it makes this statement. I love this statement. God is able. And we could stop now, couldn't we? What's your problem? God is able. What haven't you got? God is able. What have you failed in? God is able. It's just a wonderful statement. And the word able in the Bible is the same word as power. So God has the power to. God is able to. And there isn't anything that God doesn't have the power to do. So there's nothing that is beyond him. And our inadequacies are not a challenge for God. They're just glorious opportunities for him to show his omnipotence, his all ability to do whatever he chooses to do. Let me read on a bit faster than this, although we shan't get very far this morning. And God is able to make all grace abound toward you, that you, having all sufficiency in all things, may have an abundance for every good work. It's just every good work. It's just Paul is kind of bubbling over in the life of the Spirit with us. He's almost tumbling over the words. It's hard to say what you want to say. I have a recollection. It's something that really kind of stuck in my mind. Many years ago, in the summer conference down in the plinth, Peter Richards, who at that time had been in Portugal maybe for just a couple of years, and he began to share, and he broke down crying. Because he was saying he was struggling with the Portuguese language, and he had so much he wanted to say. He saw God's grace, God's fullness, God's power, the fullness of what God had done, and he had these paltry few words. But I feel like that too. Ultimately, our words are paltry. We can't even begin to say what we begin to see. And you get some sense of it like this. It's a superabundance. It's a extravagance. I don't know what a gavance is, but I'm glad there's extra gavance. There's always extra. There's always kind of more and more and more. And there's just no way of getting your arms around this and feeling you've got a handle on it now. It's always escaping in places where you see just the fullness of God's provision. But I want to show you a little bit, I'm sure you know this, but some of the context of what Paul is saying here. So I'm going to go back a chapter, but really that's still the target, that same verse. If we go back to the beginning of chapter 9, it'll just put it in its context. Paul says this to these saints at Corinth. He says, "Now, concerning the ministering to the saints, it's superfluous for me to write to you. For I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority." Okay, so let's go back in time. What Paul is saying is, you know, he's going to take up this offering for the poor Christian in Jerusalem. The Christians in Jerusalem became characterized by their poverty, and it may well be that they kind of came under financial sanctions by the Jews. Maybe they weren't allowed to trade, or they weren't allowed to kind of sell their goods, and they really were very, very hard-pressed. And other Christians in other parts of the world instinctively reached out to their brethren. It wasn't a thing of compulsion. It wasn't a tax of any kind. It was just simply an opportunity here for the life of God in the saints to express itself to the whole body. So Paul obviously had been at Corinth earlier, and the Corinthians had expressed their desire, their willingness, their intention to contribute to this offering that would go to Jerusalem. Then Paul goes to Macedonia, which is kind of the northern part of Greece. And when he gets there, he tells the Macedonian Christians of the response of the Corinthian Christians. He tells them about this generous intention of the Christians in Corinth. And the response of the Macedonians is this. You need to go back a chapter now to find the response of the Macedonians. It's chapter 8. "Moreover, brethren," chapter 8 and verse 1, "Moreover, brethren, we make known to you the grace of God bestowed on the churches of Macedonia." That's where it all starts, isn't it? In the grace of God. We want, Paul says to the Corinthians, I want you to know about the grace of God that's been given to the churches in Macedonia. We know some of the churches in Macedonia. Thessalonica, Philippi, Berea. If you read kind of Acts chapter 16 and chapter 17, you'll read of the beginnings of these churches, and you'll see the way in which their foundations in the gospel. Verse 2, that in a great trial of affliction, the abundance of their joy and their deep poverty abounded in the riches of their liberality. I'd like to see that put into a mathematical equation. Here's the first one. There's a great trial of affliction. How does this add up? A great trial of affliction. Then you add to that abundance of joy. Then you add to that deep poverty. And apparently the consequence is an abundance of riches and liberality. How does that work? It's amazing. Well, the answer's in the first verse. I want you to know about the grace of God, he says. I want you to know about the grace of God that's been manifested in the church. That this isn't the job that the accountants can cope with. You know, this is miraculous. This is the way God does things. Out of the most extraordinary ingredients, he produces amazing things. No one would put together affliction, joy, and poverty and expect to get an abundance of liberality at the end of it. Except there's this secret ingredient, which is the grace of God that's working in these people. I bear witness that according to their ability, yes, and beyond their ability, they were freely willing. Now, how do you give beyond your ability? How do you do that? I mean, if I've got £5 in my pocket and I give you £5, how can I give you six? How can I go beyond my ability? Well, these people went beyond their ability. How did they do that? Well, it's the grace of God that's bestowed upon the churches of Macedonia. I'm not getting into this kind of nonsense of seed corn and all the rest of it, where you take out a loan in order to give to somebody so that God rewards you and you end up paying off the loan and sitting in a big house. That's not what I'm talking about, if you've ever come across that sort of nonsense. That's not what I'm talking about. It's just that God is able to do these amazing things. This is kind of the miracle of the loaves and fishes all over again, but on a different dimension. This is a secret working of God whereby he is able to reveal himself in our ability and beyond our ability. We do have different abilities. In the natural, we have different abilities. That's what Jesus said in the parable that he told in Matthew chapter 25. He said that there was a man who went away, and before he went away, he gave to his servants talents according to their individual ability. As to way he saw the capacity of three individuals, and one of these individuals had a capacity for 5 talents, so he gave him 5 talents. And another had a capacity for 2 talents, so he gave him 2 talents. And another had a capacity for 1 talent, so he gave him 1 talent. And this isn't all about numbers. This isn't about what you've got. This is about what you do with what you've got. Because the king gives exactly the same, word for word, the same commendation to the one who had 5 and it became 10 as he does to the one who had 2 and it became 4. Neither of these are better than the other. Because each of these, according to their individual ability, according to the gift that God had given, traded with it and it became 2. Now here's an interesting thing, you see. God gave this man 5 because he could carry 5. He gave him 5 because he had the capacity for 5. But as a consequence of being faithful with the 5, actually his capacity increases. And into the open capacity flows more of the provision of God. So he starts off only capable of carrying 5. But because he carries his 5 faithfully, he discovers that he's now actually carrying 10. And at the end of the story, he ends up carrying 11. Doesn't he? But he only had the capacity of 5. How did that happen? Well, because he was a faithful steward of that God had trusted to him. And there's this wonderful process that if we are faithful stewards of what God gives to us, it opens out our capacity and makes it possible for God to flood in more things. He will not overload us.
It would destroy your character. It would be cruel. It would be cruel to give a child something that would be safe in the hands of an adult, but would just kind of destroy him with the capacity he has. But if the child shows in his right use, in his right stewardship of the things that are given, that his capacity is growing, well, you can continue to add more and more to him. And it doesn't damage him, as long as he grows with it. But there has to be growth with it, and not just bigger pockets. There has to be growth of character in it. So there's something happened. Occasionally, I don't know quite how this happens, you occasionally see people with sort of quite phenomenal abilities, and sometimes they crash and burn. Sometimes they crash and burn, and you just think, well, how did this happen? Was this gift too big for the character? What happened here? Was this a gift that was claimed and reached out and taken rather than given? How did this happen? Because certainly if we continue in submission and humility to God as God gives us things, there will be an increase in capacity, but there certainly won't be any increase in pride or consciousness that we're now kind of bigger and better than we used to be. Something wonderful happened to these churches in Macedonia. As they were faithful with what God gave to them, their capacity increased, and God somehow poured more into them, so that not just according to their ability, but beyond their ability. They were willing, it says here. They were freely willing. I love this, for it's just about, kind of in the history of religion, a unique financial appeal. In that it isn't actually asking people to give, it's actually asking people to receive. Because all these churches then plead with Paul, and they say, please take this money. I don't know what's behind this. I wonder almost whether Paul might have said, are you sure? I know a little bit about your circumstances. How are you managing to do this? I don't know whether he said something like this, but I know what it says here in verse 4. They implored us with much urgency that we would receive the gift and the fellowship of the ministering to the saints. This was fellowship. There was a sense of, you know, the fellowship, which fellowship actually means partnership. When it speaks of James and John and Peter and Andrew, and it says that they were partners, and it's the same root word for fellowship. They were in this together. And the thing is that the Macedonian Christians somehow, in their spirits, they knew that they were in this together with the saints in Jerusalem. This wasn't their problem. This is our family. He ain't heavy, he's my brother. That's a bit corny. But this is what they felt. They knew they were part of this. This was fellowship. It was a natural expression. It wasn't a compulsion. It wasn't something that had been imposed upon them. They hadn't had a list of things that told them what to do and what not to do. The life of God rose up in their hearts. And when they heard of the need of their brethren in Jerusalem, this was their instinct. A body's like that. You damage a part of your body and you don't have to have a committee meeting before the right hand goes out to strengthen it. Does it? If you kind of knock your left wrist or something like that, you don't have to have a big decision about what you're going to do about it. There's an instinct in the body, and the right hand will go out and it'll hold it. And this happened in the body. These Macedonian churches in touch with their living head. Isn't that how it works? My wrist is in pain, and it sends a message up to the head, and the head sends a message back down to the right hand and says, get a hold of that thing. That's how it works. It's all one body. This is what happened here. This isn't compulsion. This isn't a pattern. It's not a rule. It's not a regulation that's being set in stone that we must do the same thing. It's just simply the body functioning. It's natural to these people who are living in touch with God. They hear this thing and their response is, we're part of this. And somehow they look to God and God gives them this ability to give beyond that ability. But here's the secret, isn't it, in verse 5. And not only as we hoped, but they first gave themselves to the Lord and to us by the will of God. These Macedonian Christians are a long, long way from Jerusalem. But when they heard of this thing, their instinct was to give themselves to God and to Paul as God's agent to reach out and minister what was needed for the brethren in Jerusalem. They gave themselves first to God. It always begins there. It always begins there. Any service that we have must begin in the givenness of ourselves to God. Listen to the order in this. Jesus is speaking to Satan in the temptation in the wilderness. The temptation has been, bow down before me and I'll give you all the kingdoms of the earth. Jesus says, get behind me. It is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Did you notice the order there? You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. Don't get those the other way round. Worship will always lead to service. Service will lead to more service and more burden and more hassle, and you'll burn out. They gave themselves first to God and to us. All right? They gave themselves to God and to us. Then it goes on to say these things that... I'll go on to verse 8. And Paul now says, and this is where you get this absolute gem, right in the middle of all this practical dealing that Paul is talking about. Verse 8, I speak not by commandment, but I am testing the sincerity of your love by the diligence of others. For, this is the gem, for you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sakes he became poor, that you through his poverty might become rich. That is a thrilling verse. And it's here, right in the middle of all this practicality of life. You know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. He was rich. It's one of the clearest statements of the divinity of Christ and the pre-existence of Christ. When was Jesus of Nazareth rich? When was he rich? It must have been in pre-incarnation time, isn't it? He was never rich while he was upon the earth. It can only have been another kind of riches. So it's not talking about the riches of material wealth. It's not even talking about the riches of the universes. God can speak universes into existence with a word, if he chooses to. But before there was anything, he was rich. When there was not an angel, he was rich. Within the Godhead, there was richness of fellowship and harmony and enjoyment. And delight, that's what it says in the picture in Proverbs, that he was one before him. He delighted in him every day. Don't know how long days are in eternity, but apparently every day this delight was there. I don't know whether you've ever thought of this, but God beginning to lay down pictures and things which would serve later as illustrations, takes up a man named Abraham, and whose name already means the father, and changes his name so that it becomes the father of a multitude. Now this, of course, is an amazing picture of God, who is the father of all things and who will become the father of a multitude. But there's a very interesting thing that when Abraham's true son kind of comes on the scene, he's given a name. He's given the name of Laughter. How do you think of heaven? Do you think it is a kind of a long-faced, solemn place with angels moving about quietly so that... Or can you hear it ringing with laughter? Can you hear the delight within the Godhead? Can you hear it? He was rich. He was rich. So if that's in this equation, if that's what riches mean, what does poverty mean? It means the loss of that with which he was rich. That fellowship, that conscious communion, that oneness, that harmony. There was a time when he lost that and he became poor. That's the cross. He became poor. Why? So that you should become rich. Now we've already kind of, we've done a mathematical sum here. We've already defined what riches means. It means fellowship and harmony with God, doesn't it? In the first part of this. He was rich, okay? He became poor so that you might become rich. So when it talks about you becoming rich, what's it talking about? It's talking about you having fellowship and harmony with God and enjoying God's presence and he enjoying your presence. This is right in the middle of This is like it turns up in the middle of a business meeting. You know, this is Paul being very practical about what they're doing. And in the middle of it, you've got this absolute gem that speaks of these things. Let me read verse 12. We could go through all these, but I don't want to, because I want to go to other places if I can. Verse 12. Verse 11. For now you also must complete the doing of it, that as there was a readiness to desire it, so there also may be a completion out of what you have. The breakfast table today, I was just kind of chatting, and one of the companions at breakfast used this little phrase that I remember my mother using, and I remember my wife using to the children, and it was something along the lines of, you finish what you've started. You know, our kids grew up with that, and I grew up with that. When you start something, you finish it. And that's simply what Paul is saying to these people. It's good that you have the right understanding of things. It's good that you come to decisions in your heart. It's good. These are all necessary. It's good that you make a resolution that you will actually do something. That's wonderful. But the journey doesn't end there. That's where it starts. Do you remember the story of the prodigal son? It says, this is how the Bible tells it. It says, when he's in the far country, and he's just about ready to kind of eat the food that the pigs are eating, he says this, he sits down and he says, how many of my father's servants are well fed and I'm here starving to death? This is what I will do. Listen to his resolution. This is what I will do. I will arise and I will go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and before you, and I'm no more worthy to be called your son. Make me as one of your hired servants. Okay? It's good to have a plan. But the next verse says, so he arose and went. And the resolution has no value at all unless the verse follows it. There's no point in you having the right theology, or me having the right theology. There's no point in us knowing the right things and making the right resolution unless they're carried through. And this is what Paul is simply saying to these Corinthians. You are ahead of the pack, he said. I told the Macedonians about you, how eager you were. Okay, now's your chance. Stick to it. Do the thing you promised you would do. When I was a young Christian, I mentioned this godly couple, this Anglican minister and his wife, the rector, and Mrs. Smith. And she was from Lancashire, he was from Cambridge, and she was very Lancashire. And she could be very forthright, and I can remember as a young Christian. She would often kind of bring little bits of the Bible, and I remember bringing her a quote from, I think it's Proverbs, when it says something about that, blessed is the man who swears to his own hurt and does it. That's a kind of an obscure, for a teenager, that was an obscure kind of verse. But what she was saying is, blessed is the man who promises something, and then when he realizes it's going to be costly and will hurt him, actually still goes ahead and does it. And that kind of sunk into me as it's another one of these, what you start, you finish. And if you make a promise to somebody, I'm smiling because I can remember, I met a man once, he was an absolute rogue of a man, and he'd been an elder in a church, and the two don't always go together, but occasionally they do. he'd been an elder in a church, and his wife had died, and he'd begun to have a kind of relationship with a younger woman. But he was dallying. He was, it wasn't the church that I was part of. I was actually very close to his son, and he asked to see me because I think he wanted me to confirm what his decision was going to be about this woman, because he enjoyed her company and enjoyed doing things together, but he didn't really want to get married, although he'd actually promised her that he would get married. And people do this, you know. People do this to kind of preachers. They kind of talk to you, and sometimes you begin to tune in and you think, yeah, I know what's going on here. How many people have you talked to along this? And they've all said the same thing, but you're hoping I'll say something else so that you can do that kind of thing. So you just keep finding until you keep trying until somebody says, yes, that's the way it works. So he kind of started on this. And I don't think he ever forgave me for this, because he said, yes, he had promised to marry this woman, but the doctor had told him that he'd got a diseased heart and that it really would be very dangerous, for he might even die if he married this woman. I said, I think you should marry her. I was very patient in those days. On this principle, blessed is the man who swears to his own hurt and carries it through. Actually, he did marry in the end. So perhaps he wasn't quite such a rock. But it is important that we don't just have nice ideas. You know, we sit here and dream sweet thoughts. And wouldn't it be nice if... You listen to what God is saying. If there's a willingness in your heart, you kind of make that resolution, you make your decision, and then you go for it. You know, I remember kind of at Rora many, many years ago, ooh, a long, long time ago, when I used to come and we had the youth conference, and I was kind of one of the speakers at the youth conference. And I remember one year feeling that I should talk to the youngsters. I sat on a stool as well, I remember, about relationships. And these were kind of middle teens. And I spoke to them on the topic of "with my body I thee worship." You know that phrase from the old Anglican thing? And I gave it a subtitle, and the subtitle was, "Whose wife was that you were kissing last night?" And we talked about pressures at teenagers and things. And I illustrated something like this. And I said that there are some decisions you have to make and you stick to them no matter what afterwards. Because there are certain contexts of life that you get into, and there are so many other pressures and so many other attractions that they will take you off course unless you actually stick to the thing you decided to do. When I was in my teens, I used to do quite a bit of hiking in Derbyshire in the over Kinderscout. And in parts of that place, there's quite a bit of kind of iron ore and things. So your compass is not always a help to you. So what you have to do is, before you get into the area where all these powers are sucking away at your compass, before you get into that, you make your decisions, you take your sight as to where you're heading for, and then you put your compass in your pocket and you go. Because if you start consulting your compass halfway through this, you're going to be in trouble. And as I said then, I hope it wouldn't kind of offend you, I said, sitting in the back seat of the car is not the time to decide how far this relationship is going to go. You make that decision before you get into the car. You make that decision before you start the relationship. Because otherwise you're going to find yourself in the middle of something, and the powers that are working around you will be so strong you don't have a chance of looking to the inward conscience, amen, compass, and getting the right answers. Yeah. What you'll need to do is you need to make your decisions and then go for it. And that's what Paul is saying to these people. Make your decisions. Contemplate these things before the Lord as it seems good in your heart. Make your choices and then go for them. Let me go on a little bit. Verse 12. "For if there is first a willing mind, it is accepted according to what one has, and not according to what he does not have." Do you believe that? Or do you feel kind of inadequate because you don't have what other people have? Or you're not able to do what other people have? And or do you believe that if there is a willingness in the heart, that actually is all that matters, as long as you're prepared to carry it through? And that God measures things not according to what you don't have, but what according to you do have. He doesn't blame you for what you don't know. This was something that Moses said to the people of Israel as they were poised to go into the promised land. The secret things belong to God, but the things that are revealed are ours forever, that we may walk in them. In other words, what God has said to you, what you know you are responsible for, what you have you are responsible for, what you hold in stewardship you must give an account of. But God will not hold you accountable for what he did not give to you in stewardship. He won't. He will not blame you for not being a five-talent man. But he will hold you accountable for your one talent if he's given you a one talent. But this is really important. It's just that we must be faithful and not measure ourselves by anybody else. Remember how Paul kind of said this kind of thing on one occasion? He said, I don't judge myself. And I don't submit myself to man's judgment. There's one who judges me, it's the Lord. But I'm not going to let other people pass these judgments which change the pattern of my life because they don't think I'm doing what I ought to do. I'm not answerable to them ultimately. It isn't arrogance. Ultimately, you're answerable to God and what God has said to you and the things that he's trusted to you. So this is a very wonderful thing. How far shall we go on? Let me go backwards. Let me go way back now to 1 Chronicles in chapter 29. And please do remember that I got onto that because of what Dave was saying, and I'm not thinking primarily about finance. I'm thinking about our stewardship of what God gives to us in the body of the church, in the meetings as we gather together, in whatever context we are, where we're part of God's people, that we understand these things, that actually it's possible for us to work beyond our capacity because of grace that God gives. If you're faithful with it, if you're faithful with the little, God will give more. If you're faithful with the more, God will give more, and it'll go on in that kind of pattern. Now, this is an amazing chapter. I love this chapter. It's almost kind of the last chapter of David's life, and it's the point of transition. It's the point at which they're going to build the temple. And you remember that David had been given, 1 Chronicles chapter 29, David had been given lots of opportunities and lots of victories, and as a result of David's victories he had actually amassed an enormous fortune of precious things, gold, silver, precious stones, all kinds of things, and now the time has come. He had it in his heart. I didn't intend to say these kind of things, but this is the wonder of the sensitivity of David. I know that David got some things wrong, dramatically wrong, but there was something about David, there was a responsiveness in David's heart that when he heard the voice of God, he responded to it. And there are some very classic illustrations of that. You remember the story of Bathsheba. And he's walking on the roof of his palace. There, we'll maybe say something about that in a minute. Whether he ever ought to have had a palace is another question. His palace was actually paid for by Hiram, king of Tyre. And if you read in the scriptures, you'll know that there's a spirit behind Tyre. And it may well be that some of that kind of thing affected David. And he changed his way of looking upon his role. And he began to function like an oriental king and not like a shepherd king, which is what God had appointed him to be. But that's another kind of a part of the story. But he has hardened his conscience. He's got away with it, apparently. A baby has been born. So this is kind of 9 months down the line, and it looks as though nobody knows. Everyone's been kept quiet. It's been kept under wraps. No one knows about what he's done to Uriah. No one knows about the lies. No one. He's got away with it, apparently, until God sends Nathan with this story about the sheep, if you remember. And David is angry about it, and David says, "The man who's done that will die." And Nathan says, "You're the man." And immediately, without any justifying of himself or proving of himself, David says, "I have sinned." David was a man of tremendous passion, energy, strength at every kind of level. And it's right for somebody like that to push ahead to do the things that God has given you to do. And it's safe to do that as long as your ear is open so that at any moment God can say stop. And I sometimes say about David, he had this capacity to turn on the sixpence. He could be heading full steam in a certain direction and the word of God would come and he screeches around, he's heading off in the opposite direction. And one of the classic illustrations of that is the story of the building of the temple. God had given victories to David. He had amassed together this enormous wealth in order. He'd got all the resources ready for the temple. God had actually given to David the design for the temple by revelation. It was in his heart. He had the desire. He had the ability. He had the revelation. You say, well, surely this is a no-brainer, as they would say. This is obvious what you do. You go ahead with this thing. And then if that isn't bad enough, he has a word with his friend Nathan, and Nathan says, do what's in your heart. Do it. So David says, okay, we'll do it. And I don't know whether it was the next day or when it was, but Nathan comes back to David and says, for do it, read don't do it. amazing this is. Read it, and look at David's reaction. There is not a trace of bitterness. There's not a trace of protest. There's nothing at all. This man just simply does a 180-degree turn with praise in his heart and goes God's way. Because God said to David, and it's key, God said, there's blood on your hands. The man who has blood on his hands can't build this temple. And David actually gave this testimony to Solomon later on. And he actually adds this part to Solomon. He says that God said to him that David was a man of war and couldn't build the temple, but that God would give David a son, and he would be a man of rest and a man of peace. So they called him Peace, Shalom, Shaloman, same word. And it was Solomon's job. He was going to actually build the temple. He was going to build it from the resources that David had gained by all his bloodshed. Are you putting this together? Blood had to be shed. It had been shed. The resources for building the temple had come into existence as a result of that. But it actually wouldn't be that king that built the temple. It would be the next king. What I'm really saying is this. Don't misunderstand me. Please don't misunderstand me. It isn't the bleeding savior who built the church. It was the enthroned Christ who built the church. The wounded, bleeding Saviour had to do things, and they had to be accomplished, and they were done. But he didn't build the church until he was at his Father's right hand. And you'll see a pattern. It comes through here in this transition from David to Solomon. Chapter 29. Furthermore, King David said to all the assembly, my son Solomon, whom alone God has chosen, is young and experienced, and the work is great because... My King James, New King James Version says, the temple is not for man, but for God. But if you look in your margin, you'll see it says the palace. The word temple is not what you think about it, because people at some religions, they go into their temples. This wasn't that kind of temple. This was really God's dwelling place. This was the king's residence. This is where God would be. And it was his palace, and that's what they were building. Now for the house of my God, says David, I have prepared with all my might gold for things to be made of gold, silver for things of silver, bronze for things of bronze, iron for things of iron, wood for things of wood, onyx stones, stones to be set, glistening stones of various colors, all kinds of precious stones, marble slabs in abundance. So this is in the treasury, ready for the project. Okay? I can use the word project safely here at Rora. and then in verse 3, it says this. Moreover, that's to say, as well as that, because I have set my affection on the house of my God, I have given to the house of my God, over and above all that I have prepared for the holy house, my own special treasure of gold and silver. That's to say, this isn't just the national treasury that David has put on one side for this project. Because David's heart is in this thing, out of his own bank balance, he's making a contribution. And verse 4 says, 3,000 talents of gold, of the gold of Ophir, remember that was the finest gold, and 7,000 talents of refined silver to overlay the walls of the house. Many years ago, when would this be? This would be in the 1970s. I can remember doing some Bible studies on the tabernacle and talking a little bit about the temple and mentioning this. And I couldn't do it now because I've forgotten how heavy a talent of gold is. But I converted it into kind of pounds so that people would know just how much gold this was. And we just so happened to have in our church at that time a bullion dealer. as he was listening, he got out his calculator and he tapped these kind of figures in. And he said, can I interrupt a minute? I said, yeah, sure, go ahead. And he said, This was the 1970s. He said, David gave as his personal contribution more than the total reserves of the Federal Bank of Germany. This was when Germany was the powerhouse of kind of Europe. He said, this is a fabulous wealth that David is giving. It's a picture of David's heart towards this temple. I guess he wouldn't have had a lot left when all this was gone. It's the man. And what did Christ have left when he'd given everything? He provides the resources in his death, in the shedding of his blood. But it will be another stage in which the temple is built. Let's read on. Verse 5, the gold for the things of gold and the silver for things of silver and for all kinds of work to be done by the hands of craftsmen. Who then is willing to consecrate himself this day to the Lord? Do you know that the word consecrate in the Bible actually means to fill your hands? I think some of you know that. People who have gone into the typology of the priesthood and the ordination of Aaron will know that when it talks about consecrating Aaron and his sons, it actually, in the Hebrew, it actually says, will fill your hands. Yeah, so they fill their hands with bread as a picture of the fact that they were going to be ministering provision for God's people. So it says here, who then is willing to fill his hands this day to the Lord? To Jehovah, it says there in capital letters. Then the leaders of the fathers' houses, leaders of the tribes of Israel, the captains of thousands and of hundreds, with the officers of the king's work, offered willingly. They gave for the work of the house of God 5,000 talents and 10,000 darics of gold, 10,000 talents of silver, 18,000 talents of bronze, and 100,000 talents of iron. And whoever had precious stones gave them to the treasury of the house of the Lord, into the hand of Gehiel the Gershonite. Then the people rejoiced for that they had offered willingly, because with a loyal heart they had offered willingly to Jehovah, and King David also rejoiced greatly. Well, this is wonderful, isn't it? It just reminded me, I said that this was when I talked about Paul and said it was the most unusual financial kind of request when they urged him to take it. There's another one, of course, way back in the Old Testament, where Moses actually said to the people, will you please stop giving? Do you remember that? That was when they built the tabernacle. There's a financial request. You don't get a lot of those either. But will you please stop giving, he said. This is enormous things here. But everyone is so excited and David is rejoicing and it's all the resources are ready. Now David begins to pray. Verse 10. Then David blessed, I'm going to put the word Jehovah back where it belongs. Therefore David blessed Jehovah before all the assembly, and David said, blessed are you, Jehovah, God of Israel, our Father forever and ever. Yours, O Jehovah, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory and the majesty. For all that is in heaven and in earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Jehovah. That's a tremendous insight. This man was the king, but he knew it wasn't his kingdom. This man has been entrusted with tremendous responsibility under God, but he knows it isn't his kingdom. One day, if I can ever get round to it, I want to write something about the way that authority works in the church. Spiritual authority, its use and abuse. I've got some thoughts about it. I've got a title for it. The title is My Church, My Kingdom. Do you remember said to Peter, on this rock, said Jesus, I will build my church. Do you remember before Pilate, Jesus said this? He said, if my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight. That's a very instructive word, you know. It tells you when there's fighting that goes on in the churches, it's not his kingdom that's being built. It's somebody else's kingdom. That's what's happening. It's somebody else's kingdom. Because there's no division in his kingdom. Dave asked the question yesterday and he said, well, what causes the empires of the world ultimately to kind of fall to pieces? Nearly always two thrones, as to say a division. Because all the nations of the earth and all human institutions will fail because of this ultimately there'll be somebody else who wants a throne alongside somebody else's throne. Do you remember that's where this story starts? Way back in Isaiah? Of an angel who says, I will exalt my throne beside the throne of God. Why would you need two thrones in the universe? Why would you need two? And the end of that story is in the last chapter of the book of the Revelation. And it says, and I beheld a throne. Just one. Just one. Everything goes wrong when there's more than one throne. David understood this. He understood that this kingdom, he was a steward of it. This is my kingdom, says God. God actually said that to the people of Israel very strongly. He said, this land is my land. This is not your land. I don't know how that kind of affects folks who have a strong conviction about certain things that are happening in the national state of Israel at the present time. But God actually said very, very plainly, this is not your land, this is my land. That's why you must not buy it and sell it except under kind of leasehold. And every 50 years it must revert back to the original people because it's not your land, it's my land. It's his kingdom, it's his church. From time to time, I guess with others like this, you find yourself in meetings with kind of leaders and brothers in churches, and occasionally people will begin to talk about things that are happening in their home environments. And from time to time you'll hear people say, this is what I do in my church. And I'm sure it means nothing mostly to the people who say it, but it goes like a knife through me every time I hear it. My church? How many churches are there? I will build my church. This is my kingdom. Now this is David. He's seeing something very plain. He knows that God has given to him enormous power, actually. He has given him he's given him the affection of the people. He's a sovereign king over this territory. In one sense, he can do what he likes with it, except that he's really only a vice-regent, because God is the king of Israel, and it's God's kingdom. Do you know that way back in Deuteronomy, I think it's chapter 16, Moses, again, just before they went to the promised land, began to speak to the people about what would happen when they chose a king for themselves. Let me see if I can find it. I think it's Deuteronomy chapter 16. 17. Deuteronomy chapter 17. Remember, they're poised, remember here, this is Moses' last day. And this is what he has to say to them. Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 14. When you come to the land which the Lord your God is giving you and possess it and dwell in it and say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me. You never take God by surprise, you know. He'll declare his will plainly, but he knows what's going to happen. When you do that, verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom Jehovah your God chooses. One from among your brethren you shall set as king over you. You may not set a foreigner over you who is not your brother. But he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. For Jehovah has said to you, you shall not return that way again. You know, one of the things that it specifically tells us about Solomon is that he multiplied horses. And it actually tells you the going price for an Egyptian chariot, if you kind of dig into it. Because there was constant traffic between Israel and Egypt. Verse 17. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Solomon? Second half of verse 17. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Solomon. Now listen to this. Verse 18. Also it shall be when he sits on the throne of his kingdom that he shall write for himself a copy of this law in a book from the one before the priests and the Levites. And it shall be with him. And he shall read it all the days of his life for these reasons, that he may learn to fear Jehovah as God, and be careful to observe all the words of this law and the statutes, and that his heart may not be lifted above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandments to the right hand or to the left. It was a statute in Israel, and I don't know whether they ever kept it. It was a statute in Israel given in the days of Moses, that when the time came and they had a monarchy, that one of the first things that the king was required to do was copy out Deuteronomy, at least, maybe more than that, in his own handwriting. When I was at school, I was told that the best way of remembering things was to write it out. Your best revision tool, they used to say, is your pencil. I don't know whether they would still say such things. But if you write something out, it begins somehow to engrave it in your memory. And you remember that point was at the top hand corner of that page, just under where I'd put that. It's in your own handwriting. So this wasn't just a reference book that the kings would go back to at the priest when they wanted to make some point or understand things. They had their own handwritten copy in their own handwriting, which would bring back to them the remembrance of the day when they took on the stewardship of King of Israel and understood that they were shepherd kings and not oriental kings. And they were to write it in their own handwriting, and they were to have it with them. And they would read it every single day. Just think of that. Every day Solomon ought to have had a quiet time in the book of Deuteronomy. He'd have come across this verse a few times if he had done. Why? Well, for three reasons. That they should continue to be in awe of God. That they should remember that God was the king of Israel. That it was his kingdom. Secondly, that they should keep the law that God had entrusted to them. They were the officers of the law. The priests were the stewards of it. They kept the truth and proclaimed it. The kings were to be the ones who enforced it and brought punishment when they failed to enforce it. And thirdly, that they might remember that they were just one of the brethren that God had given a special responsibility to. They weren't different in essence. None of this divine rights of kings nonsense here. These are agents of the king who will follow out the king's. What kind of monarchy would Israel have had if they'd done this? If their kings had done this, written out their own copy, and every night as they went to bed, read some passage of it and said, Lord, am I on track? Am I on the flight path still? What's happening? God knew that these things were going to go on. Let's go back to 1 Chronicles chapter 29. We got as far as verse 11. I think, yours, O Lord, is the greatness, the power and the glory, the victory and the majesty. For all that is in earth and in heaven and on earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Jehovah. Do you remember the prayer? Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. Do you remember how it ends? For thine is the kingdom, and the glory, and the power, forever and ever. Notice the focus of that prayer. God's kingdom. God's will. Everyone under that is agents. Whatever you do, it's God's kingdom. It's for God's purpose that these things shall be done. Okay, verse 12. Both riches and honour come from you, and you reign over all. In your hand is power and might. In your hand it is to make great and to give strength to all. Verse 13, now therefore, our God, we thank you and praise your glorious name. This is wonderful. For who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? And here's a bit you Anglicans may remember. Oops, I've just pulled my microphone off.
Yeah, superfluity of cable.
Like your superfluity of fidgeting by the preacher. where were we? Yes, I said about you Anglicans. Often the offering is taken up with these words. All things come of thee, O Lord, and of thine own have we given thee. Let's see where it comes from. Verse 14, but who am I and who are my people that we should be able to offer so willingly as this? For all things come from you, and of your own have we given you. Now, if you've got a New King James Version, look at the margin. Out of your own hand have we given to you. What an amazing picture. What an amazing picture. Dave, hold the song book for me, please. This one here. Now, Sam, we stand for a minute. Imagine Dave is saying to God, I require something from you. I require that you give to me a Songs of Praise hymn book. How am I going to do that one? Well, this is how I shall do it. I will receive it from him and give it to him. How's that? Out of your own hand, I have given it to you. Thanks, Dave. Now, this may be a bit presumptuous, maybe sheer folly, but I think if we rightly understand this verse, we can settle 500 years of religious controversy in the church. Because this gives us the answer to Calvinism and Arminianism. It all comes from God, and he puts it in your hand, and you have to give it back to him. As to say, God has responsibility, you have responsibility. God will not do your part, and you certainly can't do God's part. But this is how we function in the house of God. Not from our own resources, not from the paltry collection of ideas that we've gathered over the years, but we come and we receive from him in order to give to him. Isn't this just like God? I want you to praise me with a clean heart, so I'll give you a clean heart. I want you to praise me with a right spirit, so I'll give you a right spirit. I want you to praise me with understanding, so I'll give you understanding. This is God. It's typically God, this is. All the requirements that he expects of us, he provides for us. But let's read on. Listen to this. Verse 15, for we are aliens and pilgrims, strangers and pilgrims before you, as were all our fathers, our days on earth are as a shadow and without hope. And then David says this, O Jehovah our God, all this abundance that we have prepared to build you a house for your holy name is from your hand and is all your own. Now look at verse 17. I know also, my God, that you test the heart. Now then. I know, says David, it's all come from you. This lavish, extravagant supply. It's all come from you. I know you've put it into our hands to see what we will do with it. Because it's your heart that's being tested. And it's because of this that there are such things as virtue and vice. If there was no response demanded of human beings, if we had no responsibility in this, there'd be no virtue, there'd be no vice. It would just be a script that had been written that we were just kind of slowly working our way through. But God puts things into our hands and then says, what will you do with it? What will you do with this thing? The provision isn't ours. It doesn't come from our brilliance or excellence. It's his, but he insists that there shall be this living human link in the working out of his purposes. That it will be done, that his will be done through men and women who are rightly related with him, who understand that it's all from him. He is Lord of his kingdom. I'm tempted to kind of go off on tangents, but it's his will that matters. Over the last so many years, maybe kind of 30 or 40 years, there's been an ever-increasing slide in churches' understandings towards a kind of a project-governed pattern of doing things. It's kind of management technique, and it can produce very efficient results in business and in industry. And you need to have mission statements and vision statements and five-year plans and organization charts with everyone with the right name in the middle of it, so you know exactly who relates to who and whether you've got dotted lines or straight lines and whether you've got matrix government and all the rest of it. And It's wonderfully efficient, but it has nothing at all to do with my church and my kingdom. This is my church. This is my kingdom. But I want you to be involved in it, says God. I don't need you. Is that true? Actually, it's not true. But it's only not true because God has decided it won't be true. You know how he gave to his disciples a mission, not a mission statement, just a mission, just a job to do. And he said to them, they're going to Jerusalem and where this crossroads, and you'll find a young donkey there, and bring him to me. Now, I have need of him, says the Lord of heaven and earth, the donkey. You know, angels and cherubim and flying chariots in Ezekiel, and he needs a donkey. Why would he need a donkey? Well, he'll need a donkey because he'll said, I'm going to use a donkey. In the Old Testament prophecies, he says, I'm going to come on a donkey. Now that I've committed myself to coming on a donkey, I shall need a donkey. Can you see that? It's not because intrinsically he needs a donkey. It's because he's decided to need a donkey. Now, intrinsically, he does not need you or me. But he has decided to need you and me. And because he's decided to need you and me, he can't do what he wants to do without you and me. Now, you're not to get pompous and big-headed, because everything that you receive comes out of his own hand anyway. Everything that he requires of you is actually his gift to you, but he does insist that you are involved, and that you're not a spectator, and that you will be held accountable for what you did with what you were given. And we will be. There's a wonderful place of security and rest in all this. There isn't any hassle in it. There's nothing driving in this. There are no targets. There's nothing to hit. There's nothing that you have to accomplish, you know. And if you do, they'll double it for next month anyway. There's none of that kind of stuff. This is fellowship. This is co-workers together with God. God didn't need a house. Didn't need any of this, and if he'd needed it, he could have spoken one into existence. But he's determined that he'll do things through us. What does Paul say when he writes to the Romans? One amazing phrase, he says, God will bruise Satan. Who will bruise him? God will bruise him. God will bruise Satan under your feet. Shortly. Couldn't he bruise him under his own feet? Yes, he could. But what would that prove? But if God can bruise him under your feet, you who are a nobody, you who are less than the angels, now we've got something to praise God for. Now we've got something in which God's splendor and glory is seen. Now we see the treasure hidden in earthen vessels. If God can bruise Satan under your feet, well, that's just wonderful. But he'll only do it because you receive his provision for you and you cooperate with him. Right, time's going, but very quickly I want to say this. In that passage that Dave was reading to us last night about from 2 Peter, and you've got Peter saying, you must add this, you must add this, you must add this. Actually, the word is supply. You must supply this, you must supply this, you must supply this. You say, wow, this is a bit of a list. How am I going to supply all this? Well, he says, well, there are given to you exceeding great and precious promises whereby you may become partakers of the divine nature. So they're given to you, so now you add this. You take responsibility for this part. In Peter, you've got adding things, and the list has a tremendous similarity to the list in Galatians, which is the fruit of the Spirit. You do it and put some, write both things down, put some cross lines and see how it all connects up. And then in Galatians, we're talking about fruit, and that's fine because the fruit tree just kind of sits there and sucks it all in and produces fruit, and it's wonderful. And that's half of the picture. And here's the other half of the picture. God has given to you all things that pertain to life and godliness, and you must take them in faith and make them your own. And you must add to this, this, and you must add to this. And the result of this is this amazing prophecy, this amazing promise, that if you do these things, God guarantees that you'll never be fruitful or barren in your service for God. He guarantees fruitfulness if you if you keep on the track. Paul says, if you live in the Spirit, walk in the Spirit. That's Galatians. Different words in Greek for walk. That one actually means almost a kind of walk in file, like someone marching. If you, let me put it like this. If you live in the Spirit, progress in the Spirit. If you live in the Spirit, progress. Make tracks, cover some distance in the Spirit. Go on, go on, go on, go on. Paul wrote to Timothy and he said, take heed to yourself. I won't go through all of it. He said, take heed to yourself, because in doing so, when men see you're progressing, you'll actually save both yourself and those that hear you. Your progress. Keep on adding, keep on adding. Anybody can add. It's more complicated to multiply, but that's, God does the multiplying. You just do the adding. He multiplies grace and whatever it is towards you, and you do the adding. One at a time. I don't want to kind of prolong this now, but one at a time, as God speaks to you. It was thrilling what Irene said this morning about the way in which she had been, if you like, kind of bound with kind of drugs and cigarettes and all the rest of it. Until the one moment came when God said, this is the time, do it. Just the one thing. Now, there are some people who get into such tangles and become so discouraged and depressed because they're trying all kinds of things which actually are later on in God's agenda. Mm. Listen to what he's saying to you. Listen, if he's pointing out some aspect of your life that's not perfectly aligned to his will, he's not doing it as an exercise. He's doing it because he's pointing to you where the resource is. Amen. Come to him, receive it from his hand, and give it to him. And he will give it to you handful by handful. He will not give you a granary where you can store a whole life supply of stuff that you can just dip into whenever you want it. He will give it to you handful by handful as you need it, day by day. This is a thrilling adventure that God has drawn us into. And it's not to be heavy and crushing, but we are to be diligent and understand that what God trusts to us, he will require an account of, but that we are co-workers together with him. Let's stop. It's 12:30. All things come from thee, O Lord, and out of thine own hand have we given thee. What did we give that we hadn't been given? What is the Lord of any significance that wasn't born in heaven? Lord, this really is an amazing miracle of grace and faith, that you should include us in your plans and purposes, that you should embrace us, though we have failed and rebelled and thoroughly and permanently disqualified ourselves from any part of all this. You've made the rebel a priest and a king. You've given us responsibility, delegated to us responsibility, put things into our hands in this kingdom, trusted to us. You have put us in trust with the gospel. Now help us, Lord, by that same Spirit to understand and recognize the times and the moments, and to do the things that you've given us to do, Lord, and to add this to that, and then to add another, and then to add another, just step by step in that steady process as we look to you to make your will done on earth as is in heaven. Lord, this is your kingdom. We want you to have the glory and the honor and all the power. And we want to be constantly mindful, Lord, in these things, that it's your church and it's your kingdom. Amen.